From the Roots Up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
It's 11 a.m. This is the Taylor Report, our new start time. And we are in a transition for the Taylor Report. We will be also on at 5 p.m. today and probably for a period of time as we all adjust to the new schedule. But it's Monday, 11 a.m., the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We often have Phil Conlon here, who is with Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. However, Phil is, we're going to say he's on assignment. I think that's the word. When you don't know where the guy is, you say he's on assignment. And we're going to be talking about a number of things. A phrase I'd like to use at the beginning is, oh my Gaza. Oh my Gaza. We have a nightmare situation unfolding, as you would have heard on the Democracy Now! From Amy Goodman. I thought excellent reporting, as horrible as it unfolds, but brilliant work journalistically. Our guest today, starting off, is Eve Engler. And Eve is a political activist and author of 12 books, dubbed as one of the most important voices on the Canadian left. The Globe and Mail has situated him in the mold of I.F. Stone. Very, very, very high praise. Eve Engler lives in Montreal. He's the co-author of a new book with Owen Schalk. Owen Schalk is the author of Canada in Afghanistan, a story of military, diplomatic, political, and media failure, 2003-2023. He contributes to a weekly column into Canadian Dimension. He lives in rural Manitoba. And by the way, the book includes poems by a good friend of ours, Rob Rov. Canada, and the title is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. I believe we're joined by Eve Engler now. Are you there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Well, we're always saying, I'm doing okay, but I tell you, these are rough times, aren't they? You're an activist. You not only write well, but you put yourself on the line, and this Gaza thing is a nightmare. I wonder if maybe we could use it as a background to a discussion of your book, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. By the way, it's Baraka Books. Canada is, your point in this book is this is basically lift the mask and say Canada doesn't really abide by any of its self-declared identification of being democratic. Indeed, it's hostile around the world to people who are trying to become democratic. And I wonder if I could situate it this way. Here we are at the United Nations. It's a democratic body. States attend. We have a representative, Bob Rae. And they have determined that the people of Gaza are under an illegal occupation. They're under violent assault. And it's very important to aid them. And we have a thing called UNRWA, which provides food, medicine. And Canada recently said, well, we're not going to give anything to that, in the face of all the other nations. Isn't that an international expression of the problem you're talking about in your book?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's even worse than you presented there. I mean, the Canadian government did that the same day that the International Court of Justice found there was a plausible case of genocide and explicitly called for increased humanitarian assistance. And the Canadian government's reaction to that ruling was to ignore the ruling, not even say sort of a perfunctory that, you know, Israel had to abide by international law. And instead of doing that, even that basic statement. They just came out and cut funding to Palestinian refugees, and obviously, principally, the worst impacted are in Gaza. And but this is just one of the many examples of Canada's enabling of Palestinian dispossession and Israel's violence. And this is not something new. This goes back, over a century. I think in light of this latest book, we do have a small section on Canada's anti-democratic behavior, concretely in terms of after Hamas won the legislative elections in 2006, the Canadian government was right at the forefront in basically stoking inter-Palestinian violence and disunity. And the Harper government, cut off assistance after Israel was the first country to cut off assistance to the Palestinians. And then after elections, and then when there's a Palestinian unity government, the Canadian government did everything they could to destroy that Palestinian unity government, and then including funding for policing and military assistance to the Palestinian Authority while it was fighting the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority while it was fighting Hamas. And that's also partly tied into creating a force to oversee Israel's occupation in the West Bank. So the concretely, in terms of, if you go back historically, Canadians helped to try to conquer Gaza for the British back in during World War One. There was a Canadian who had been in charge of the German West Africa after the British and French took control of German West Africa. He led the charge to conquer Gaza in 1917, and hundreds of Canadians had helped in ultimately supporting Allenby's mission to conquer Palestine. So this is a long history of Canada supporting the colonization of these lands, and we're seeing that play out in a really crass and horrific way today, where more than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, and we're in a situation now where that 30,000 number is going to be not only increased by direct killings, but also by the horrors of famine and health consequences of lack of food and water and stuff like that.
Yeah, the one I'm hearing today, Democracy Now! Is treating it in great depth as actual famine, not maybe famine, partly famine. And here Canada sits, saying no, because our friend in Tel Aviv says we're going to cut off the UNRWA's been bad, therefore, and without any evidence. By the way, as a journalist, it must intrigue you that now, according to UNRWA and according to other agencies, including, I understand, U.S. intelligence, nobody's actually shown any evidence that anybody in UNRWA was involved in the October 7th, and yet here we are on the brink of famine. I guess that's a kind of a two question. Second one being, isn't Canada close to being indictable under the way the South Africa has framed the case?
Well, yeah, I mean, with regards to UNRWA, we should be clear that the Canadian government was the second country to cut off. The Americans announced they were suspending funding. And this was, of course, partly a public relations gambit by Israel to try to turn attention away from the International Court of Justice ruling. And that's why they announced this more than 3 months after October 7th. They announced this alleged UNRWA employees' involvement in October 7th. They announced that over three months later. So that was part of it. Canada was a second country, and it was very clearly it was following Washington, and it was following the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, Israel lobby group that pressed, and it was like 3 hours later. And they did it with no evidence, and they don't claim to have any evidence. They just followed Israel, and Israel has yet to even provide that evidence. That's the nature of this situation. We just believe Israel, even as it slaughters huge numbers. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the second part of the question, I'm losing that second here. What was the second part of that?
I'm sorry. A reminder? Yeah. Canada's should be, as I was hearing the arguments, actually, as you know, of course, there have been the two cases in front of the ICJ. One gets confused about them, at least I do. But the several countries said that given the preliminary decision from the ICJ, any country that aids in any way with money, arms, etc., is involved in the crime that is being committed in Gaza. And it seems to me Canada has crossed that line.
Oh, far across that line. And there's they far crossed that line, and the Nicaraguans have already taken Canada, UK, Germany, and Netherlands very specifically for the arms deliveries. And the arms, Canada's been selling weapons to Israel for a long time. The actual amount is not that significant in terms of direct over recent years. It's usually been a bit above $20 million a year. But that only hits a little bit of what's actually being sent, because all the weapons that we sell to the U.S. And Canadian arms companies are mostly branch plants of the U.S. Military-industrial complex. And all of the arms transfers to the U.S., we don't know about them, because the defense production sharing arrangement going back to the 1950s basically acts as this. It's just one, Canada and U.S. arms industry is just one entity. So tens of millions of dollars more would be going via components of U.S. weapons that are being transferred to Israel. But what we know is that since October 7th, and this is from very good reporting from the Maple, the Canadian government has sent, I think it's about $28.5 million in weapons since October 7th. And what's interesting about this is that it appears what's happened is amidst the genocide, the Canadian Global Affairs Canada has sped up the permit process of granting permits to weapons to Israel. So they got it down to 4 days, which is just like off the charts of what the usual time it takes to okay a permit for arms. They got it down to 4 days. So this is you know, bureaucracy really working well to make sure that the genocidal country is stocked with the needed the needed components of weaponry. So Nicaragua has announced that it was bringing Canada to the ICJ over that, its complicity. But also yesterday or the day before, the United Nations specifically cited Canada in a statement about violations of the ICJ complicity with genocide. And regarding Canada's arms sales, so you know, the arms sales one is also, it's one that's gotten a lot of attention, and you know, it's rightfully, obviously, it's an important demand to stop to bring in an arms embargo, to stop granting the permits. But in fact, it's only one piece. I mean, even just on the military front, the Canadian government has been allowing all these charities, these registered charities in Canada, that are basically subsidized by the Canadian taxpayer, to fund the Israeli military. The one that's got the most attention, of course, is the Hesek Foundation, set up by Jerry Schwartz and Heather Reisman, the Onyx and Indigo, the owners of Onyx and Indigo. But they've been sending around $10 million a year to projects that are essentially assisting the Israeli military. And they're, you know, obviously these are billionaires, so they're getting the top tax brackets. So about 40% of that money would be subsidized by the Canadian state. Yes. And that's just one. There's multiple of these charities supporting the Israeli military. And this is, it should be noted, is an absolute direct opposition, violation of Canada Revenue Agency rules, which state absolutely clearly that it's not charitable to support another country's military, and yet this continues. And then if you go on, you look at the Canadians who are actually fighting in Gaza, right? We don't know exactly how many, but certainly dozens, could even be into the hundreds of Canadians that are fighting in Gaza, and they're being induced to join the Israeli military in probable violation of the Foreign Enlistment Act. And so even just direct Canadian support, military support, beyond the broader, you know, the Canada Trade Agreement, all these other charities that support projects in Israel, all kinds of other ways in which Canada enables Israel's violence, direct military support is actually not insignificant, and it appears that Melanie Jolie and Justin Trudeau could find themselves, pursued legally for this.
By the way, I love the paradox here because of your book, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. And what you're alluding to, I find this, we're sort of a strange moment here because countries, as you just mentioned, like Nicaragua and others are starting to look at Canada, whereas everyone here in the white West European world, we're used to doing all the judging and all the accusing. And the ground is shifting, and we're starting to get a little taste of international democracy where, by the way, I mean, with the arms, providing things, the rule is that if you have a conflict zone, you don't send weapons into a conflict zone, certainly not without some, democratic process saying that's what we want to do.
Yeah, well, the public... Canadian public opinion, going back 6 weeks in, it was already saying very strong support for a ceasefire. So presumably a strong majority of Canadians don't want to be sending weapons into to the country that's committing genocide. Mm-hmm. With regards to the kind of broader question of Nicaragua, and this is, there is no, we're just the exposing of the double standards and hypocrisy. We're at the 2-year anniversary of Russia's invasion, and Canadian officials, all these big moralizing comments about international law and sovereignty and stuff like that. And then you contrast it with what they're doing with regards to Gaza and Palestine in general. And the whole world understands, outside of maybe some NATO countries. And I think even within the NATO countries, more and more of the population understand that this is just absolutely crass double standards. We also are, I think it's important to note this week, this is not going to get much attention, but this week is the 20th anniversary, February 29th, is the 20th anniversary of the Canada-US-France overthrow of Haiti's elected government. Mm-hmm. And in our book, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, this is really sort of the penultimate example case of a Canadian coup that we detail. We detail about 20 of them, but this is really Canada was involved in every facet of the destabilization campaign, funding opposition groups, building the international coalition that would perpetrate the coup, the media disinformation, and then ultimately, actually invading Haiti, Canadian Special Forces with U.S. Marines, and literally physically taking the elected president, putting him on a plane, and dumping him in the Central African Republic.
Yeah, they didn't even know where he was going. I remember that here he was, the elected most popular president in modern history of Haiti, and they said he was on a plane and nobody even knew where he was going. It was like a kidnapping.
Total kidnapping, and just done in this just crass, anti-democratic, imperialist behavior, and yet we crawl on and on about democracy. So this is the 20th anniversary of this, and it's also being done in the light, just over the weekend, the Canadian government announced another $80 million for a Kenya. The U.S. put up about $200 million. I think France put up a bit more, I don't know the exact number, tens of millions more, and $300 million for U.S., Canada mostly, to pay for Kenya to lead a new foreign mission into Haiti. And so this is the fruits of 20 years of a 20-year coup that over 2,000 elected officials is just an absolute spiral downwards of almost every indicator in Haiti. And now we're right back at funding another foreign military intervention. It's just completely remarkable, and almost nobody in the media will even mention the fact that this is 20-year anniversary of this horrible coup that Canada perpetrated.
Yeah. We're speaking to Eve Engler, co-author of Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. By the way, this is the Taylor Report. We're at our new time, 11 a.m., and we will also be broadcast at 5. But, Eve, that seems to me that your work, I recall it vividly. You were the one who did the most, in my opinion, to detail Canada's involvement in the planned, carefully planned removal of the Democratic president of Haiti. And it does seem to be, maybe this is a sign, people talk about it, the crumbling empire problem, but only a few months ago, the Americans were talking as though they could get Canada to send troops to Haiti, but that seemed to kind of, somebody developed cold feet. And now, you mentioned Kenya, but isn't it true that the Kenyan parliament their Supreme Court says you can't send Kenyan troops? And it's becoming what I would call, I guess, the fumbled handoff. The Americans hand it to Canada. They kicked the ball around, and now it's gone to Kenya. They can't seem to get their imperialist act together.
Yeah, and this funding that Canada announced over the weekend, and obviously the behind the scenes plotting, it looks like it's not only not wanted by the majority of Haitians, but it's violating Kenyan law, and it basically looks like the Kenyan president is just going to ignore the court and move forward. And so the U.S. and Canada, of course, are funding that, and so it takes on even a sort of anti-democratic dimension within Kenya. But yeah, this is if you look back at this coup, it's 20 years ago. As of Thursday, it's just a remarkable story. I mean, they campaigned to demonize Jean-Bertrand Aristide. You know, they began the destabilization of the president before the president was even elected. And the starting of the demonization is an election that he wasn't in office to oversee, and he wasn't participating in. It was this May 2000 legislative and mayoral election. And basically what happened is his political party won the vast majority of elected positions in the country, and the opposition realized that they were going to not be winning any elections for a long time. The presidential election wasn't until later in the year. And the Canadian government, through the Organization of American States, was right at the center of creating this totally false claim that there was these dubious elections, and then they used this dubious legislative election claim to taint the presidential election that was upcoming. And even though everyone knew Aristide was going to win by a large margin, there was never even any doubt. And then they began this whole process of justifying cutting off assistance, cutting off World Bank funding that had already been agreed to the government, to the Haitian government, based upon the supposed problem in seven senatorial seats that Tommy Lavalas, Aristide's party, would have won anyways, but they claim that there's a complicated electoral tabulation question that ultimately totally irrelevant. And they basically use that all to justify this multi-year campaign that ultimately led to Canadian troops intervening. And as we detail in the book, this is an extreme case, but we detail more than 20 cases. We're going back to Arbenz in Guatemala, Mossadegh in Iran, where Canada was either passively complicit in a usually U.S.-led, U.S.-British sometimes, a coup, or a very active participant. Mm-hmm. And so we're not just saying that, like, Canada supported dictatorships, right? There's many instances over the decades, where Canada supported different dictatorships. What we're saying is that they were active or passive participants in the actual overthrow of elections or elected government. And that goes completely against this notion that, Canada's this force for democracy. But in fact, we show consistently, repeatedly over the decades, where the Canadian government has been more than willing to participate in crass violations of the most basic democratic kind of standards.
Yeah. Again, it's Eve Engler. The book is Canada's long fight against democracy. And Eve, I thought that that we should see if we could prevail on the current investigation by Canada's parliament into foreign interference, that we ought to try to get you and your book in front of them, because foreign interference is a pretty serious business, and they're trying to scare Canadians of, oh, somebody might be trying to interfere. But your book makes this all relatively laughable because you have 20 coups that you're writing about in your book where Canada is deeply interfering in the internal affairs of at least 20 countries.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important point. It relativizes this whole kind of panic about foreign interference in Canada. And obviously, as you delve into the details of the claims of the foreign interference into Canada, you find that a lot of them collapse. And then you find, in fact, that a lot of the people who are talking about foreign interference in Canada, they're actually funded by the U.S. Embassy or the National Endowment for Democracy. I'm speaking specifically about groups like the Uyghur Advocacy Project, that's literally funded directly to influence Canadian Parliament, funded by the U.S. government to influence Canada's Parliament. I'm talking about people like the disinfo watch there at the McDonnell Laurier Institute, Marcus Kolga. Again, that was all set up with U.S. money. So a lot of even the claims of foreign interference, of specifically Chinese foreign interference, in fact, are actually examples of U.S. Interference into Canadian politics.
A lot of these people. Who have problems because of violence in Hong Kong seem to have a United States Congress and Canadian parliamentarians as chums. Sort of inquiring minds would say, aren't we kind of butting in? That isn't our country, by the way. And if we do, are we a little bit surprised if somebody were to maybe twist our ear a little for doing it? By the way, now on this point, I really have to, the one that really stands out, and you write about it, of course, in the book, Canada's Long War Against Democracy, a long fight against democracy. Could you help us on the historical point? Do we still recognize Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela?
We don't still recognize Juan Guaido. There was a...
He was cooed by his own friends, wasn't he?
Yeah, we in the book we detail this as a failed example. This is almost on par with the Haiti example of Canadian involvement. Canada helped bring the coalition together behind Juan Guaido, funded opposition groups. Was set up the Lima group of foreign countries that tried to overthrow Venezuela's government. So we were heavily involved in many facets of the whole. Juan Guaido failed ultimately coup process, but what? So the Canadian government a few months ago backed away, kind of put out a statement that essentially backed away from Guaido, but still kind of recognizes the opposition. Forgetting exactly how they've kind of navigated this, but essentially recognizes the opposition. As the legitimate governments, not Guaido kind of anymore, but they've been stepping towards rebuilding relations with Venezuela. But over about a week ago, the Canadian government criticized the Venezuelan government over I think the detention of somebody who was considered an opposition kind of political figure, and that prompted a rebuttal from the Venezuelan government. So the Canadian government continues to sort of passively, I would say, less aggressively criticize Venezuela and sort of contribute to this bid to try to demonize Maduro. But it's been a failed. That's one. Fortunately, it's been a failed project of...
And a Liberal Party star, Chrystia Freeland, she and others had something called the Lima Group. I mean, that almost dynamited the South America, what's it called, the OAU? There is a hemispheric democratic group.
The CELAC, but in fact, the Lima
Group. And they formed a faction called the Lima Group.
Yeah, well, it was even worse than that because the Lima Group was actually formed in 2017 because they couldn't get what they wanted through the Organization of American States. And as everyone should know, the OAS is something that's always been a long time, very pro-U.S. kind of body. But at that point, there were OAS was refusing to participate in the sort of demonization and destabilization of Maduro's government. And so then they created the Lima Group of just like the most right-wing governments in the hemisphere.
And bent on foreign interference, absolutely interfering with them.
Well, that was the whole point. I mean, there were many governments in the Caribbean that weren't necessarily too supportive of Maduro, but they were their position was not one of defending Maduro, but was a position of defending international law and opposing foreign interference. And that's why they weren't going along with some of what Canada was pushing and the U.S. was pushing at the OAS. And so, therefore, Canada set up this new body to be an explicit foreign interference agent, which ultimately led to the point. I mean, the interference got so extreme that they basically coordinated the opposition behind a marginal opposition politician in a Caracas park, announcing that he was the legitimate president of the country. I mean, Juan Guaido was somebody that very few Venezuelans even knew of before he claimed
he was better known in Canada than he was in Venezuela.
Yeah, he the only reason he was even it was like a four-party rotation of the opposition parties because they come to a coalition. So Guaido's Voluntad Popular was the smallest of the main opposition parties, and they were doing a rotation of the leadership of the opposition position, and it was falling on Voluntad Popular, his party, and so he was. Huh. Presented by his party, and that Canada was right at the center of coordinating that both international and domestic Venezuelan, you know, backing of this totally kind of extreme effort to you know, decide who was the legitimate president of Venezuela.
Yeah, again, it's Eve Englert, and the book is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, Baraka Books. Lastly, I think I want to get you to talk about, since Ukraine's in the news, and we're hearing that there's going to be upping, because Trump put his foot down. Now everybody says yes, we're going to send more money, more troops, and all that. Although, I guess it's not credible. But you point out that it was an ugly moment in 2014. I remember, of course, the American woman in the State Department, Victoria Nuland. But Canada, particularly Chrystia Freeland, was deeply involved in what was a domestic matter where the Ukrainians were sorting out their own affairs. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's really, we're seeing right now how the propaganda system works, right? So we hear all these stories in the media right now about 2 years anniversary of Russia's invasion. Find me a story that delves into the 10-year anniversary, which also passed this week, of the Canadian-U.S. Sponsored coup in against Viktor Yanukovych back in 2014. You won't find basically any attention of that, even though anybody with a superficial understanding of Ukrainian history understands that is what spiraled into Russia taking Crimea, what spiraled into a war in the east, what spiraled into this low-level proxy war, which, of course, Russia massively escalated 2 years ago. So this event is absolutely centrally important to understanding what's going on in Ukraine today. But the Canadian media just, you know, basic total silence on this 10-year anniversary. Now, and then you get into what Canada actually did. And this is one where they weren't quite as important as in Haiti, but they were substantive players. And you know, some of the people respond, some people even on the left respond, well, okay, they just supported this popular Maidan protest movement that began in late 2013, and Canada was just supporting this sort of popular, you know, disgust with this corrupt leader. That's you know, that is partly true, but that is completely minimizing how involved Canada was. And if you go back and you look, Canada sent election observers back in 2010 to the elections. Before they went to elections, they were anti-Yanukovych, but nonetheless, he won. They agreed that he won. It was a legitimate election. His party then won the 2012 legislative elections as well. But Stephen Harper begins right away by late 2010, within months of Yanukovych, he begins the process of demonizing Yanukovych. He has a trip there. He brings to Kyiv. He brings opposition Ukrainian Canadian Congress people on his trip who openly criticize, who openly attack the elected president, say dustbin of history and stuff like that. And then you see this whole steps. 2012, Canadian officials go there, demonize, they fund opposition groups, demonize, then it just builds their opposition, their demonization just keeps building up to the point where there is this protest. So Canada's basically stoking what turns into the Maidan protest. And then during the Maidan protest, John Baird, Canada's foreign minister, early in the Maidan protest, December 7th, I believe it was, 2013, he actually goes to Maidan Square. This is the foreign minister of Canada goes to an opposition protest, which is basically calling for the overthrow of the elected president. And then later on in the Maidan protest, the Canadian embassy is used. This is reported by Canadian press. Used for more than a week by opposition. They basically use it as a base of their opposition to the elected government. This is total interference in Ukrainian affairs. There's a whole bunch of other facets. The main spokesperson for Canadian embassy is a prominent anti-Yanukovych activist. She's just like really prominent anti-Yanukovych activist. She's the spokesperson for Canada's embassy in Kyiv. There's a whole bunch of sanctions, all these things that Canada imposes. And then once Yanukovych is ousted, we work hard funding-wise. Harper makes two trips there in like under 2 months. We work hard to consolidate what is an unconstitutional transfer of power. So Canada's role in the coup against Yanukovych, you can say what you want about Yanukovych. You can say he's corrupt. You can make whatever claim you have. But the reality was he was elected. We agreed he was elected, and we worked to destabilize and overthrow his government. And that played an important role in all kinds of horrific political developments that have been played out over the last 10 years, but it's basically unmentionable in the dominant media.
Yeah, and that's why this book is so important, Canada's long fight against democracy, Eve Engler. And by the way, there should be an inquiry into foreign interference, parentheses, by Canada, and Eve Engler and Owen Schock should be the first witnesses. Hey, thank you very, very much, Eve. You've been very generous with your time.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, doke. Bye-bye. That's Eve Engler, and this is the Taylor Report, and I will mention that Eve is going to be talking in Hamilton and in Kitchener-Waterloo, but we don't have the dates as yet, but stay tuned for future programs. We'll have those for you. This is Taylor Report. I guess we're going to have a little bit of good music.